stepped into the truck beside him. Then Mahmoud heard the truck's doors slam and the engine start, and they were moving. Mahmoud's breathing finally came back to something like normal, and he was able to sit up and open his bleary eyes. There were no windows in the van, and it was dark, but Mahmoud was able to see the other 9 men with him, all of them red-eyed and crying and coughing from the tear gas, and all of them handcuffed with zip ties, including Mahmoud's father. "Dad!" Mahmoud cried. He worked his way across the floor of the bouncing van on his knees and fell into his father. They put their heads together. "Where are Mom and Walid?" Mahmoud asked.
"I don't know. I lost them in the chaos," Dad said.
His eyes were red-ringed, and his face was wet from tears and snot. He looked terrible, and Mahmoud realized he must look just as bad. Mahmoud thought the van would stop soon, but it drove on and on.
"Where do you think we're going?" Mahmoud asked.
"I don't know. I can't reach my phone," Dad said. "But we've been in this van for a long time. Maybe they're taking us to Austria."
"No," one of the other men said. "They're taking us to prison."
"Prison? For what?" Mahmoud wondered.
"We're just refugees. We haven't done anything wrong."
The van stopped, and Mahmoud and the other refugees were unloaded into a building one of the soldiers called an immigration detention center. But Mahmoud could tell it was really a prison. It was a long, single-story building with a barbed wire fence surrounding it, guarded by Hungarian soldiers with automatic rifles. A soldier cut the zip tie off Mahmoud's wrists. Mahmoud expected the relief to be instant, but instead, his hands went from numb to on fire, like the tingling needles he felt in his leg after it fell asleep, times 1,000. He cried out in pain, hands shaking, as he and his father were hurried into a cell with cinder block walls on 3 sides and metal bars on the front. 8 other men were pushed inside with them, and up and down the hall, more prison cells were filling with refugees. A soldier slammed the barred door shut, and it locked with an electronic bolt.
"We're not criminals!"
one of the other men in the cell yelled at him.
"We didn't ask for civil war! We didn't want to leave our homes!" another man yelled.
"We're refugees!"
Mahmoud yelled, unable to stay silent any longer.
"We need help!"
The soldier ignored them and walked away. Mahmoud felt helpless all over again, and he kicked the bars in anger. There were similar cries of innocence and rage from the other cells, but soon they were overtaken by separated families trying to find each other without being able to see from cell to cell.
"Fatima? Walid?"
Mahmoud's father called, and Mahmoud yelled their names with him. But if his mother and brother were here, they didn't answer.
"We'll find them," Dad assured Mahmoud.
But Mahmoud didn't understand how his father could be so sure. They hadn't found Hana, so what made him think they would find Mom and Walid? What if they had lost them forever? Mahmoud was beside himself. This trip, this odyssey, was pulling his family apart, stripping them away like leaves from the trees in the fall. It was all he could do not to panic. His breath came quick and his heart hammered in his chest.
"I don't believe it. They took us almost all the way to Austria," Mahmoud's father said, checking his iPhone at last. "It's just another hour by car. We're outside a little town in the north of Hungary called Jaur."
Almost all the way to Austria, Mahmoud thought. But instead of helping them along, the Hungarians had thrown them in prison. Hours passed, and Mahmoud went from panic to frustration to despair. They sat in the cell without food or water, and only one metal toilet attached to the wall. All Mahmoud could think about was Mom and Walid. Were they in some Hungarian prison somewhere too, or had they been pushed back across the border into Serbia? How would he and Dad ever find them again? He slumped against the wall.
"I have to say, this is the worst hotel I've ever stayed in," Dad said.
He was trying to joke again. His father was always joking, But Mahmoud didn't think that any of this was funny at all. At last, soldiers with nightsticks came to their cell and told them in Arabic to line up to be processed.
"We don't want to be processed," Dad said. "We just want to get to Austria. Why not just take us all the way to the border? We never wanted to stay in Hungary anyway."
A soldier whacked him in the back with his nightstick, and Mahmoud's father collapsed to the ground.
"We don't want your filth here either," the guard yelled in Arabic. "You're all parasites."
He kicked Mahmoud's father in the back, and another soldier hit Mahmoud's father again and again with his nightstick.
"No!" Mahmoud cried. "No, don't! Stop!"
Mahmoud begged. He couldn't bear to see his father beaten, but what could he do?
"We'll do it! We'll be processed," Mahmoud told the guards.
That was all it took, to surrender. The guards stopped beating his father and ordered everyone to line up. Mahmoud helped his father to his feet. Dad leaned heavily against him, needing his son for support. Together, they shuffled in line along the far side of the hallway, away from the cells. Men and women and children watched them with hopeful eyes as they passed, looking for their husbands and brothers and sons. And then Mahmoud saw them, his mother and Walid. They were in a cell with other women and children.
"Yusuf! Mahmoud!" Mahmoud's mother cried.
"Fatima!"
Mahmoud's father cried with relief, and he stepped toward her.
Whack!
A soldier clubbed Mahmoud's father with his nightstick, and Dad went down again in a heap. Mahmoud and his mother cried out at the same time.
"Stay in line!"
the soldier yelled. Mahmoud's mother reached for them through the bars.
"Yusuf!" she cried.
"No, Mom, don't!"
Mahmoud cried. A soldier clanged his nightstick against the metal bars, and she retreated inside her cell. Mahmoud got his father up again and helped him into what the soldiers called the processing center. There, clerks sat behind long tables taking down information from the refugees. When Mahmoud and his father got to the front of their line, a man in a blue uniform asked them if they wanted to claim asylum in Hungary.
"Stay here?
In Hungary? After you have beaten me? Locked my family up like common criminals?"
Mahmoud's father asked, fists clenched and shaking. Mahmoud still had to help him to stand.
"Are you joking? Why can't you just let us go on to Austria? Why do we need to be processed? We don't want to stay here one second longer than we have to."
The policeman shrugged. "I'm just doing my job," he said. Mahmoud's father slammed his hand flat on the table, making Mahmoud jump.
"I wouldn't live in this awful country, even if it was made of gold!"
The policeman filled in an answer on a form.
"Then you will be sent back to Serbia," he said without looking up at them. "And if you return to Hungary, you will be arrested."
Mahmoud's father didn't speak again, not even to make a joke. Mahmoud answered the rest of the clerk's questions about their names and birth dates and places of birth, then helped his father back to their cell with the other inmates. Mahmoud's mother cried out for them again as they passed, but Mahmoud's father didn't acknowledge her, and Mahmoud didn't respond. He knew that would only bring down the wrath of the guards again. Head down, hoodie up, eyes on the ground. Be unimportant. Blend in. Disappear. That was how you avoided the bullies.
Joseph. Antwerp, Belgium, 1939. 36 days from home. The St. Louis was throwing a party, even bigger than the one it had thrown the night before they'd reached Cuba. This one had the euphoria of more than 900 people who had been at death's door and were suddenly, miraculously saved. Belgium, Holland, France, and England had agreed to divide the refugees among them. None of the passengers were going back to Germany. Joseph's mother wasn't alone on the dance floor anymore. She was joined by dozens of couples, all dancing with giddy abandon. Joseph had even taken a turn around the floor with her. Passengers sang songs and played the piano with the orchestra, and one man who knew magic tricks entertained Ruthie and the other little kids in the corner of the social hall. In another corner, Joseph laughed as passengers took turns telling jokes. Most of the jokes were about taking holiday cruises to Cuba. But the best was when one of the passengers got up and read from the brochure that advertised the MS St. Louis. "The St. Louis is a ship on which everyone travels securely and lives in comfort," he read. You could barely hear him over the hooting. "There is everything one can wish for," the man read, gasping for breath. "That makes life on board a pleasure. We hope you'll want to travel on the St. Louis again and again." Joseph laughed so hard he cried. If he never saw the MS St. Louis again in his life, he would die happy. The next morning, the ship docked at a pier in Antwerp, Belgium. Negotiations between Captain Schroeder and the four countries still took time, and it was a full day later when, under the grim portrait of Adolf Hitler, Joseph and his family joined the other passengers in the social hall again to find out where they would be going. Representatives from the four countries sat at a long table at the front of the hall, arguing over which passengers each would take. Every country wanted only the passengers with the best chances of getting accepted by America, so they could ship the refugees back out as quickly as possible. Joseph hoped they would get England, because it was the farthest away from Nazi Germany, safe across the English Channel. But when everything was settled, he and his family were assigned to France. They would be among the third group to disembark, after the Jewish refugees going to Belgium and the Netherlands were delivered, but before the last group sailed for Great Britain. The first group left that afternoon. Joseph watched with most of the other passengers as the refugees going to Belgium disembarked. Joseph didn't want to go to Belgium, but he was jealous nonetheless. Like everybody else, he was ready to get off this ship.
"Think of it, we traveled 10,000 miles on board the St. Louis," one of the men leaving for Belgium told the other passengers as he stepped onto the gangplank, "only to end up 300 miles from where we started."
The line got a laugh, but a sad one. Joseph was all too aware of the long shadow cast by Nazi Germany, and so was everyone else. Still, as long as the Nazis stayed in Germany, they would all be safe, wouldn't they? The next day, 181 passengers disembarked in the city of Rotterdam, even though Holland wouldn't let the St. Louis dock at their pier, just like in Havana. The refugees were taken into town by another ship and escorted by police boats. As they sailed on to France, Joseph wandered the decks. The ship had a strange, empty feeling to it. Half the passengers were gone. The morning they arrived in Boulogne, France, the 288 passengers who were traveling on to England gathered on sea deck to say farewell to Joseph and the others who were disembarking.
"We're doing England tomorrow," Joseph heard one of them say. "June 21st. That's exactly 40 days and 40 nights in a boat. Now, where have I heard that story before?"
Joseph smiled, remembering the story of Noah from the Torah. But he felt less like Noah and more like Moses, wandering in the desert for 40 years before reaching the Promised Land. Was that France? The Promised Land, at last? Joseph could only pray it was. He picked up his suitcase in one hand, took Ruthie's hand with his other, and led her and their mother down the ramp into Boulogne.
"You see," Mama said, "I told you somebody would think of something. Now stay close and don't lose your coats."
At the bottom of the ramp, Joseph watched as one of the other passengers got down on his hands and knees and kissed the ground. If he hadn't had his hands full, Joseph might have done the same thing. The Secretary General of the French Refugee Assistance Committee officially welcomed them to France, and the porters on the docks moved quickly to carry the passengers' luggage for them, refusing any and all tips offered. Maybe this was the Promised Land after all. Joseph and his mother and sister spent the night in a hotel in Boulogne, and then they were taken by train to Le Mans, where they were put up in a cheap lodging house. Days passed, and life went on. Joseph's mother got work doing other people's laundry. Ruthie went to kindergarten at last, and Joseph went to school for the first time in months, but because he couldn't speak French, they put him in the first grade. 13 years old, a man,
and they put him in a classroom with 7-year-olds. It was humiliating. Joseph promised himself he would learn to speak French over the summer, or die trying. He never got the chance. 2 months later, Germany invaded Poland, touching off a new world war. 8 months after that, Germany invaded France, and Joseph and his mother and sister were on the run again.
Isabel, off the coast of Florida, 1994, 5 days from home. Isabel's mother cried out, "It's coming! It's coming!" Isabel didn't know if she meant the baby or the Coast Guard ship, or both. "Paddle!" Amara cried. Isabel paddled harder. She could see the shore, could see the beach umbrellas folded up for the night but still stuck in the sand. Strings of lights, palm trees, more music. A salsa now. It was all so close. But so was the Coast Guard ship. It bore down on them, its red light flashing, its powerful motor thrumming, water sluicing from its bow. Isabel's heart hammered. It was going to catch them. They weren't going to make it. Lito froze. "It's happening again," he said.
"What? What do you mean?" Isabel asked, panting.
"When I was a young man, I was a policeman,"
Lito said, his eyes wild.
"There was a ship full of Jews from Europe. And we sent them back. I sent them back. Sent them back to die when we could so easily have taken them in. It was all politics, but they were people. Real people. I met them. I knew them by name."
"I don't understand," Isabel said.
What did her grandfather's story have to do with anything?
"Paddle!"
Isabel's father cried. The Coast Guard boat was almost on top of them.
"Don't you see?" Lito said. "The Jewish people on the ship were seeking asylum, just like us. They needed a place to hide from Hitler, from the Nazis. Mañana, we told them. We'll let you in mañana. But we never did."
Lito was crying now, distraught.
"We sent them back to Europe and Hitler and the Holocaust. Back to their deaths. How many of them died because we turned them away? Because I was just doing my job."
Isabel didn't know what ship her grandfather was talking about, but she knew about the Holocaust from school. The millions of European Jews who had been murdered by the Nazis. And now her grandfather was saying that a ship full of Jewish refugees had come to Cuba when he was a young man? That he had helped to send them away? Mañana. Suddenly, Isabel understood why her grandfather had been whispering that word over and over again for days. Why it haunted him. When would the Jews be let into Cuba? Mañana. When would their boat reach America? Mañana. Mañana had never come for the Jewish people on that ship, Isabel realized. Would mañana never come for Isabel and her family either? A calm came over Lito, as though he'd come to some sort of understanding, some decision.
"I see it now, Chavela. All of it. The past, the present, the future. All my life, I kept waiting for things to get better. For the bright promise of mañana. But a funny thing happened while I was waiting for the world to change, Chavela. It didn't. Because I didn't change it. I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. Take care of your mother and baby brother for me."
"Lito, what are you—"
"Don't stop rowing for shore,"
Isabel's grandfather yelled to everyone else. He kissed Isabel on the cheek, surprising her, and then stood and jumped into the ocean.
"Lito!" Isabel cried. Lito! Papa!